Hi, you're listening to the CDC podcast. CDC is the UK's impact investor and development finance institution. And in this episode of the podcast, we share some of the highlights from one of our recent Insight events. The Insight series aims to share practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge, and research. Now, this particular event explored the role of market-creating innovations in development. And in this podcast, you'll hear from two experts in this field. Afosa Ajomo, who is the co-author of a book called The Prosperity Paradox, which explores this subject in a lot more detail. And Nikunj Jinsi, who is a hugely experienced investor in venture capital in developing countries. Both of our guests were in conversation with CDC's General Counsel and Head of External Relations, Colin Buckley. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Colin, who'll start by setting the scene.
My name is Colin Buckley, and I will be your chair today. Today's event examines the power of market-creating innovations in development. All of us recognize the problems of persistent poverty experienced by nations, and we have tried a succession of development models based on central strategies, only to see poverty in many countries increase rather than abate. What if there was a way, instead of relying on top-down solutions, to harness the natural entrepreneurship of people to fuel innovation that doesn't only create companies, but makes entire markets? That is the thesis that our guest today, Afosa Ajomo, promises in the book, The Prosperity Paradox, that he co-authored. So, Afosa is a fellow at the Christensen Institute on Disruptive Innovation and a senior research fellow at Harvard Business School. Afosa, many thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Colin. It's my pleasure to be here. It's good to, I can't see all of you, but it's good to know you're here with us. Hope you're keeping safe.
Thanks. So, Afosa, you lead research on global prosperity at the Christensen Institute. And I wondered, just to start things off, if you would tell us a bit about your work there and why market-creating innovation is relevant for developing economies.
Thanks, Colin. I think the first thing I'll share is a story of how I even began to do this work. I'm originally from Nigeria and was fortunate to come to the U.S. to study. In 2000, but in 2008, I began reading books on poverty, economics, development, and it gripped me like nothing had ever gripped me before. And I wanted to do something about it. And you know, perhaps there are people in the audience this has happened to. And so what did I do? I started a nonprofit organization. That is sort of the dominant strategy on helping people in middle, low-income countries. I started a nonprofit and went into poor communities and built wells and did some education investment, things like that. But it turns out all the wells we built, Colin, broke. And I could not somehow come back to the U.S., ask money from friends, like raise tens of thousands of dollars and go into communities and build wells, knowing that they were ultimately going to break in 6 to 9 months. That's when it occurred to me that there is something fundamentally wrong with that strategy, or at least incomplete, because that strategy, right, of providing a resource to a poor community, a much needed resource, is really the microcosm of the entire development industry. Or at least much of it, perhaps not the entire thing, but much of it. It's this notion of let's go to a poor region, see what they lack, whether it's education, we build schools, healthcare, we build hospitals, infrastructure, we build roads, water, we build wells, without really appreciating the critical mechanism at the core that keeps those things sustainable. After that happened to me several times, failing really, I decided to go to business school, and that's where I met Professor Christensen, who unfortunately passed away about a year ago. And his way of thinking really changed my life, the way I see the world. And my hope is that it can share some of those ideas today. And his focus was on innovation, on a certain type of innovation called market creating innovation as the critical missing piece in this development puzzle. And at the core of it, I'll explain briefly, is innovations that transform complicated and expensive products into products that are simple and affordable, so many, many more people in society can afford them. When an innovator creates a new market and that makes products more affordable, three things happen. The first is they create jobs because they need many more people to make the product, sell the product, market the product, and so on. The second is, as a result of this mechanism, it leads to profits. And those profits then provide taxes that governments and other organizations, civil society can use to improve society. And the third, which is somewhat ambiguous, nebulous, but it's this sort of cultural shift that happens that begins to value entrepreneurship, innovation, and management. And so a perfect example of this, which I believe the CDC was actually an investor, is if you think of mobile telephony across Africa as an example. I like to use Africa, not just because I'm from there, but because I'm, you know, if it can happen in Africa, I think it can happen almost anywhere in the world. I mean, Africa is the poorest continent in terms of GDP, represents roughly 3% of global GDP, and it's about 16% of global population, and so on. But CDC invested in a company by the name of Celtel that was founded by Mo Ibrahim. 20 years ago, he wants to go and give cell phones to the average African. I mean, people said, you're crazy, this will never work. There's corruption, poverty, no infrastructure. But you know, you fast forward to today, not only is Mo Ibrahim a billionaire, but Celtel, which became Airtel, and other companies have catalyzed and created a market for mobile phones across Africa. And now it's sort of like, oh, of course that happened. Of course the technology, the timing was right. But that's not entirely true. 20 years ago, it was really hard for him to get this off the ground. But look at the impact it has had, right? Over 100 mobile phone companies on the continent, provides millions of jobs, represents a couple hundred billion dollars in economic value. That's the power of market creating innovations in development.
It's interesting. I mean, you take an example from Africa, but I think most of us, if we were thinking about which economies in the last maybe 20 years have really experienced the most rapid growth and also have a tradition for, you know, creating markets and being entrepreneurial and innovative, we think of China and India. And I'm wondering, I mean, are there common factors in the experience of China and India that we can use in developing economies or in Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of why we, in the book we wrote, The Prosperity Paradox, and a lot of my research, we stayed away from China is because I think many people assume China has primarily or perhaps even only prospered because the government tells everybody what to do, right? Do this, do that. And I would ask the listeners to check out a researcher, Yuan Yuang Ang. She's an economist out of University of Michigan, an expert on China, wrote two amazing books, How China Escaped the Poverty Trap and China's Gilded Age. I think it's a paradox of vast corruption and economic boom or something, right? So to check out her book. And what really happened in China is a similar mechanism happened. Yes, China does export a lot of products, but it has also figured out a way to create markets within China. And the incentives that the government has created for you know, regional and local governments support an increase in investments, right? So as a public servant, a bureaucrat, you are incentivized for increase in investment to your region. Now, there are some issues with that, but the point is, The incentive isn't necessarily to, you know, fix schools, fix healthcare, fix all the issues, which many medium and low income countries' governments can't really fix. The incentive is to drive investment, support the private sector, and that is ultimately going to create the much needed taxes to then help fix those things. So that's a critical step that gets missed. Now, the struggle in, I think, economic research is when we say China and we say India, we look at them from the top down, right? And we say, well, China has this kind of government, India has this type of government. What did they do on a policy level? Which provides some insight. But I think if we step back and look at the mechanisms, right? If we divorce what is going on the government level, look at the mechanisms that have made certain parts of India thrive and China, increase GDP per capita from a couple hundred dollars to close to $10,000 over the last 40 years, that mechanism is pretty much identical. And it's this notion of making things simple and affordable so many people in the region can get access to it.
Okay, so let's go back then to Africa. And I mean, we have in Celtel a great example. And then we have in China and India, in a sense, a library, as you say, of mechanisms that have proven successful. I mean, how do we put those together and how do we make more market creating innovations like Celtel in Africa?
Yes. So I don't know that there is one, answer or one thing.
No silver bullet.
I thought building a well and providing some funding for education was a silver bullet, right? I mean, you read economic research and you say, oh, if you do this, it increases income by this much. But the struggle with that is, you know, look at the pandemic. Look at what has happened. Over the last year, rich countries have spent upwards of 20% of their GDP on economic stimulus. Low-income countries, which have much lower GDPs, have spent roughly 2-3%. And so if our focus remains for the next 30, 40 years on alleviating poverty, building wells, if you will, metaphorically speaking, we have to ask, is that the best we can do, right? And so to the folks listening, the question is not does providing a well have some value in a community, you know, literally and metaphorically speaking, for 6 months to a year or even a couple of years? Of course it does. But we have to ask a different question. Is that the best we can do? And I don't think it is. I really don't. And so to your question about how we do this, the first is simple, but what we're doing now, talking about it, highlighting the central role innovation, private enterprise, not just any private enterprise that focuses on market creating innovation has on an economy is key. And then the second is doing the hard work of building the ecosystem. That's a lot of what we're actually doing now, in that when we published the Prosperity Paradox a couple of years ago now, January 2019, we introduced this notion of market creating innovation and the impact it can have on prosperity. And as I traveled the world pre-COVID to speak about this idea, many people reached out and said, okay, how do we do this? How do we actually actualize it in our economy? How do we estimate the size of non-consumption and so on? And so, you know, over the last year, we've been working with a group at MIT, the Legatum Center for Development and Entrepreneurship, and we're launching a market creating innovation project, really, that comprises of, a boot camp to sort of introduce entrepreneurs and managers to these key concepts of market creating innovation and how you build them. A lot of this is based on Professor Christensen's innovation theories. And then we want to build a community of these folks to put them in a community, provide specialized coaching that can help again, you with what your venture or your idea, with the knowledge that simply providing knowledge is not enough. We have to build an ecosystem. So we just announced it yesterday, actually. So it's fortuitous that we're getting to talk about this today.
Okay, great. Look, at this point, let me bring in Nikunj Jinsi. And Nikunj has over 20 years of venture capital experience in developing markets, including a stint as global head for venture capital at IFC. He currently acts as senior advisor to a range of European institutions, including, I'm happy to say, CDC, where he sits on one of our investment committees. So Nikunj, you've been in the virtual green room here listening to EFOSA, and clearly VC investment has a critical role to play in all of this when we talk about entrepreneurs and innovation. Drawing on your experience in this space, I mean, how does EFOSA's work resonate with you and the experience of investing in developing economies?
Yeah, thanks, Colin, for the introduction, and thanks, EFOSA, for the very eloquent overview of your work. And a short answer to your question, Colin, absolutely, it totally is spot on the work one looks at in VC nowadays in developing markets. I think the one point people may want to understand is that venture capital in developing markets, especially in Africa, perhaps less so in markets like China, but especially in Africa, it is fundamentally different from what one sees in Silicon Valley. It is all about looking at underlying economies and trying to address problems and pain points, many of them put forward by EFOSA just now, attracting that or addressing that with the technology-driven solutions that are simple in nature and form. EFOSA worked with Professor Christensen, who I also had the honor of meeting a few times. And it's actually Professor Christensen who developed the term disruptive technologies, which has subsequently been, I would say, misused or overly used, not in the right context. But what it means is what EFOSA explained earlier, it's providing innovation through simple technology solutions and addressing the bottom of the market and changing, disrupting an existing sector in those markets significantly by using simple solutions that are scalable as well. And the beauty about VC is that it looks at technology that is scalable. So you don't have the well problem that EFOSA has. You're looking at things that are repeatable and scalable. And the other thing that's happened specifically in Africa in the last 5 years is that digitization has come ashore, and the digitization of economies made possible through companies such as Celtel and others, tower sharing companies and so forth, but now also made possible through the access specifically that the youth and the population has in Africa to mobile data. And the very fact that they're able to access mobile data has resulted into the fact that you see pockets of entrepreneurship come up throughout Africa to address many of the issues EFOSA talks about. And I'm very hopeful, although it's going to be painful and it's going to be a long path, I'm very hopeful to develop sustainable solutions that are long-term and are as well financially profitable in the long run.
Thanks a lot, Nikunj. I wonder on the back of those examples, whether we can talk a little bit about scale. So in Silicon Valley venture capital, you're often talking about the famous hockey stick, you know, that you can take a lot of risk around innovation because even though your hit rate is low, once you create a market, the market is so large, it rewards the enormous, you know, failure risk of trying to be disruptive, trying to create innovation. In Africa, by comparison, the markets are quite small. I mean, Nigeria, the GDP of Nigeria is roughly the same size of Seattle. So I'm going to start with EFOSA on this question. I mean, how do we square this? How do companies afford this market innovation where the upside may just not be big enough?
Yeah, I mean, let me answer. Clay taught me to try to answer questions with stories. In the late 1980s, a prominent consulting firm goes to AT&T and says, AT&T goes to a prominent consulting firm and says, we want to know if we should invest in mobile phone technology. How big is the market going to be at the turn of the century? Consulting firm does a lot of research, rigorous, the best in the world, really, and comes and says about 900,000. Market's not going to, I mean, it's your decision. You can invest if you want, but it's roughly 1 million mobile phones. AT&T decides to hit pause because they looked at the technology at the time, the earning power, how much the mobile phones cost, who used them, and said there's not a big enough market. 2001, we had over 1 billion mobile phones in the world. Today, we have more mobile phones than we have people. And so the question is, how could AT&T, global leader, prominent consulting firm, miss it? They weren't necessarily wrong, but they were using the wrong metrics and wrong trajectory. I think to answer your question, Colin, when we look at the economy of Nigeria and we say it's about the size of Seattle, that is true. You know, you look at the GDPs and all, that is true. You look at the earning power, disposable income of the average Nigerian does not come anywhere close to perhaps even the poorest, you know, people at a lower income in the United States. But if we assess markets that way, then we're never really going to make progress. What we have to do is say Nigeria is in a market creation phase. It's in an entirely different phase of development than Seattle is, which means the products and services that I now have to provide for the average Nigerian customer has to look necessarily different than the average Seattleite. And so if I'm providing health insurance for the average Nigerian, they don't need a $5,000 deductible or a $10,000, you know, $50 a month premium. You start with something much smaller because where you start is not where you end. And so a company called MicroInsure took the idea of insurance to many emerging economies and now provides insurance at a pittance for people who make less than $3-$4 a day. They've got upwards of 65 million customers today in, you know, Kenya, Ghana, Bangladesh, several emerging economies, and they're profitable in over 80% of the countries where they've done business. You know, you and I know Uber is not yet profitable. And so I think we really have to appreciate the fact that we got to go into these economies thinking about the innovations and the business models differently.
So thanks, Hafosa. Nikunj, from an investor's point of view, how do you struggle with this?
Yes and no. I think exactly to what Hafosa was saying, the key here is to find local solutions for the local market, not looking at technology transformation or technology transfer and looking to scale down the cost of that technology. That's not going to work. There are many, many models that are very, very local for the markets. And I think one thing to add to what Hafosa said is that much like India, for example, which is not a homogenous market, there are different cultures, people speak a different language out there. That's not all that different from what you have in sub-Saharan Africa. Yet India has found solutions that are truly scalable through, you know, fintech, Paytm, for example, that is less scaled up. Similarly, in Africa, you know, people need to be banked, whether they live in Francophone Africa or in the eastern part of Africa, they need to be banked. So M-Pesa was the first one that came out with a solution that was widely accepted. Now you're finding lots more players in the fintech side that are providing solutions on the mobile wallet side, on the peer-to-peer lending side, on the SME lending side, on the credit-driven side, on the micro-insurance side. So tons of innovation happening that is locally developed, that is meant towards for the region. So I can't think of any business that I have looked at in which they set up a business plan day one that they said, well, let's look at Tanzania only, or let's look at Nigeria only. These are regional businesses day one. And as a result, you're seeing regional entrepreneurial hubs being developed in places like Lagos, in Accra, in Nairobi. These are all meant to attract regional entrepreneurs, but also develop day one regional businesses with local solutions.
So thank you very much to our guests, Hafosa Ajomo and Nikunj Jinzi. And thanks also to Colin for hosting. And you can find more from our Insights series on our website, cdcgroup.com. Otherwise, that's pretty much it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening to it. And remember to subscribe to this show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another episode very soon.